responsibility, and he became CEO in the year 2000. And that year is significant, as you will later on learn. And his claim to fame, one could say, is the fact that he took Cigna International, and they are now represented even in China. And he obviously became very successful, but he grew up in Philadelphia, in a middle-class neighborhood in Philadelphia, where he still goes from time to time and hangs out with his old buddies from high school. He is accompanied today by his wife, Ellen. Welcome, Ellen. Nice to have you here. And they have no less than... They have three children together, and they have five grandchildren. Ed is very much involved with his children, and one of the things that he's doing right now is, together with his son Patrick, he's opening an ice cream parlor and burger parlor in not in Philadelphia, in the town of Media, Pennsylvania. And one interesting thing with regard to that is that they have had to go to dairy school, a two-week school having to do with how to handle dairy products and how to produce ice cream. I'd like to hear about that sometime, actually. He is only on one public board, and that is Marsh McLellan. And the reason for that is that he simply wants to do more with the family. But education is very important to Ed and his wife. And together with friends, he founded a Catholic pre-K through 8th grade school in the town of Chester, right? And Catholic education had all but disappeared until Ed and his friends took this on. And he's also a chairman of the board of Loyola College in Maryland. But back to the year 2000, when he was named chairman of Cigna, Ed then stated and firmly believed that no CEO should stay in the job for longer than 10 years. So there we are in December of 2009, Ed then retired after 10 years as head of Cigna and at the tender age of 58. I give you Ed Hanway.
You certainly may.
I just want to say one more thing, because this is such a complex and difficult subject. Ed's remarks will be just a few minutes shorter than our normal remarks are, and that will give you more time to formulate your questions, and Ed hopes that you have many of them, so start thinking about it and start writing your questions. And Bill Allen, you can ask your group to start collecting them early on. Thank you.
Sorry, Ed.
That's all right. Thanks, Ulla, for that introduction. The other individual who acknowledged that they graduated or are involved with Loyola University in Maryland will meet me in the parking lot. We have a discussion to have with Father Michael when this is over. Let me start by saying this really is a momentous occasion. It's a pleasure to be here to address this group. As you heard, having retired about a year ago, my wife Ellen and I are fairly new to the Naples community, but I think it's fair to say that in our brief time here, we have really come to appreciate not only the weather, which just looking out the window you can see is terrific, but also the diversity of intellectual and cultural activities that are available here, of which this forum is clearly an impressive part. So my congratulations to all of you who have been part of this for a long time. I also want to acknowledge our students who received their awards today. Congratulations, it's a tremendous achievement. My topic today is American healthcare and particularly the so-called healthcare reform. Now, I must admit, however, that in some ways today I feel a little like the late Elizabeth Taylor's seventh husband must have felt. I know what I'm supposed to do, but I'm not really sure how to make it interesting. You have to think about that one a little bit, don't you? But seriously, healthcare and healthcare reform is a very important and timely topic. And also, it's one that is fiercely personal for all of us. Healthcare is also a very complicated topic, both how it is delivered and how it is paid for. Now, I make my comments today not as a medical professional. You heard my background. But as someone who served for 10 years as the CEO of the nation's fourth largest private health insurer, the Cigna Corporation. That's a company I served for over 31 years. Cigna is a fairly unique company, as Ula referenced, particularly as it relates to its U.S. competitors, because it does business in approximately 30 countries around the world, and it derives about 15 or 20% of its revenue outside of the United States. So this global operation provides a somewhat interesting perspective when evaluating healthcare insurance reform in the U.S. And I'm going to try to highlight a few of those perspectives in my remarks today. So I want to cover three topics today. First, some brief background facts on our healthcare system as a context for this reform that we're experiencing. Second, my views on healthcare reform as embodied in the what is often referred to as Obamacare legislation, which just celebrated, interestingly, its first anniversary. And third and finally, I will provide some what I think are very encouraging statistics and conclusions from a five-year study of so-called consumer-directed health plans and the improvement in the health status and cost that they enabled for participants in those programs, basically through private market-based initiatives. So let's get started. First, a little background. Now, much of this you have likely already heard or read about, but I'd like to share it with you anyway. Healthcare expenditures in the U.S. represent approximately 16% or over one-sixth of the U.S. economy, and this percentage is expected to grow materially. A big number, and it continues to grow very rapidly. This percentage is also one of the highest, if not the highest, among the OECD countries. And you also often hear that what we get for this 16% of GDP is a lot less than what other countries get. And oftentimes the fact put behind that is that our life expectancy is lower than most of the other OECD countries. So the saying goes, we spend more, we get less. And this is often stated as a reason that we need healthcare reform. But what you may not hear as much is that our life expectancy is lower, almost entirely due to a higher rate of infant mortality. In fact, the U.S. has one of the highest infant mortality rates in the world. A McKinsey Institute study a few years ago pointed out that virtually the entire difference in life expectancy in the U.S. versus other developed countries is due to this higher infant mortality rate, and that higher rate in the U.S. is driven disproportionately by the rate in the minority population in six or seven key states. Now, I, for one, would have liked to have heard a lot more discussion about reform ideas that deal with issues like this one. But politically, right now at least, that doesn't seem to be possible. Now, while it is true that we spend more on health care than other countries, I would also suggest that we get more, not less, in return. One good example of this, cancer survival rates in the U.S., for the five leading causes of cancer death, are anywhere from 15 to over 60% higher in the U.S. than they are in the U.K., for example. And the U.S. clearly remains the destination of choice for many healthcare specialty areas, even for, as you've probably read, some Canadian elected officials. It's also important to note that quality, while generally higher here than in other countries, is at times inconsistent, and it does clearly have room for improvement. A couple of examples of this. An Institute of Medicine study has pointed out that approximately 50 to 100,000 deaths each year are a result of avoidable medical errors. And I always find this stat particularly interesting. Fully 50% of American heart attack patients are not prescribed or complying with aspirin therapy. So I think you would agree that there are ways we can improve quality. And finally, it's also true that access to the best medical care, delivered in the most efficient and effective setting, is uneven. Depending on whose numbers you believe, there are somewhere around 35 to 40 million people who lack health insurance for at least a part of their lives. Now, while many of these people access care in various ways, often using the emergency room as their primary source of routine care, this is clearly not the most effective or cost-efficient way to ensure that their health is maintained. So, in summary, we should view healthcare reform in the context of a U.S. system that is very expensive, with a growth rate of spending that is unsustainable, but with innovations and outcomes that lead the world in many areas. A system in which quality improvements are necessary, and I would suggest very achievable, and a system where access for all can and must be improved. Now, interestingly, the three stated goals of the recent healthcare reform were very consistent with these issues. They are increased access, cost reduction, and improved quality. I think we all heard these objectives repeated very often during the recent debates. So, how effective is the new legislation going to be in accomplishing these goals? Well, I thought what I would do is give you my personal handicapping. I've never been very successful at the racetrack, so don't take this to the bank. First, increased access. It is estimated that the reforms will provide insurance coverage to approximately 30 million people who did not have it before. This is accomplished through a mandate on individuals and businesses to have and or offer coverage, as well as a significant expansion of Medicaid. State insurance exchanges must be established by 2014 to facilitate access to insurance products which both meet minimum coverage requirements and which are subsidized at some level for families making up to almost $70,000 plus per year. Now, under the legislation as passed, access to insurance coverage will be significantly increased. There is no question here. Now, there is clearly a challenge to the individual mandate, that is, requiring individuals to purchase insurance or pay a penalty. That challenge is on constitutional grounds, and it's going to play out in the courts. And this obviously could impact just how many more people actually acquire insurance coverage. So on access, only time will tell, but clearly, the number of people with insurance coverage will increase dramatically. How about the second objective, reduce cost? First, let me say that the idea that the legislation pays for itself is somewhat questionable at best. I tried to be kind there. There are many reasons to be skeptical of this claim, but I'll give you the two that I think are most obvious. As calculated, the Congressional Budget Office used 10 years of revenues and only 8 years of expenses for the first 10 years of the legislation. Now, I'm not going to speculate as to why. You can draw your own conclusions on that. Ellen and I only wish our budget worked that way. Second, the cost calculations assume that physician reimbursement rates in Medicare, which is roughly 50% of medical costs in the country, would be reduced by almost 20% in January of 2011 and then be held flat in future years as called for in previous legislation that was designed to ensure Medicare's future solvency. Now, not surprisingly, the January 2011 reduction was overturned by Congress, just as previous mandated reductions has been. As a result, the expectation that future rates will increase along with inflation off of this lower base is now just not possible. So much for that so-called pay for. In reality, a major source of cost savings in the bill was eliminated by Congress less than 90 days after the bill was passed. There are also relatively few reforms that actually address the cost of actually delivering care, aside from a few demonstration projects that do deal with reimbursement methodology and coordination of care across the delivery system. And to be fair, I should note that Medicare is moving to address the cost and quality issue. One example of these efforts is their decision to penalize hospitals who have higher than normal readmission rates by reducing the reimbursements to those hospitals. Another missing element of the reform is the lack of any meaningful reform of medical malpractice rates and terms and so forth. And that's a significant source of unnecessary costs, I think, as we all know. So the reality is, as long as our healthcare system reimburses hospitals, physicians, and other providers primarily on the number of services that are offered, as opposed to a system that also rewards quality and outcomes, it's likely that healthcare inflation will continue to exceed the overall rate of inflation. What about the third objective of healthcare reform, improved quality? The legislation does include funds for quality initiatives and information technology programs that are directed at improving quality and outcomes. The question is, are those likely to have any major impact anytime soon? And again, I would say here, only time will tell. So it is likely that the first objective of reform, which is to increase access to health insurance, will be achieved. The unknown at this point, and I would suggest what is far less certain, is at what cost and with what improvement in quality and outcomes. Another clear reality is that government involvement in our healthcare system will increase significantly as a result of the reforms, both in terms of who will be required to have insurance coverage, what that coverage must be, and ultimately who will be required to pay for it, either individuals or taxpayers. It is interesting to note, from my perspective, that in almost every other country where my former employer does business, most of which have some form of government-provided health care, those governments are seeking to reduce their roles and expand private market solutions for health insurance needs, while we're going in the other direction. It's one of the reasons my company is seeing such significant growth outside the United States in various healthcare insurance products. Now, I want to conclude my remarks by sharing some interesting data that comes not from legislated healthcare reform, but rather from the private healthcare insurance marketplace. Now, you know, employers still pick up on average about 60 to 65% of their employees' healthcare costs, and some pick up much more. So they have a keen interest in not only controlling costs, but also in improving the health of their employee populations in support of increased productivity. For years, most employers who were offering health insurance focused on effectively managing the cost of care for their employees once they got sick. But today, many employers are focused on keeping their employees healthy and avoiding costly illnesses, many of which can be prevented. This change of focus to keeping people healthy and incenting individual behaviors to do so has resulted in a generation of products that are referred to generically as consumer-directed health insurance. These products often contain many of the features of traditional insurance policies combined with a healthcare savings account, or HSA. Now, I will acknowledge many critics of these policies allege that they simply allow employers to pass more costs to their employees, and as a result actually reduce coverage and benefits, this so-called cost shifting to employees. This accusation is simply not accurate. The reality is that many large employers actually spend the same amount of money on consumer-directed policies for their employees as they did their old traditional policies. They just spend it very, very differently. The new consumer-directed insurance plans operate on the premise that when consumers of healthcare, all of us, have better information on quality and cost, combined with financial incentives, they will make better choices as healthcare consumers. Now, I'm not going to bore you with all the details of these plans, but I do want to highlight their objectives, and then I want to give you some facts from a 5-year study of their results. The consumer-directed plan's objectives include, first, promotion of healthy behaviors, such as getting annual physicals, compliance with guidelines for preventive screening, such as mammography and colonoscopy, cervical cancer and prostate screenings, and participating in disease management programs for conditions such as asthma and diabetes. Second objective is the use of quality and cost data to pick the best hospital or doctor or center of excellence. So when services are required, they are delivered in the most effective and efficient setting. Assistance is often provided in this effort by personal health advisors assigned to individuals that are provided by the insurer or the plan administrator. And third is promoting healthy behavior and informed decision making through cost sharing and reimbursement incentives. So, what have been the results of these new programs? Well, this 5-year study suggests that the cost aspects have been very impressive. Compared to traditional insurance programs, the overall costs of the consumer-directed plans were 26% less over that 5-year period. And very importantly, this is with the same out-of-pocket cost to those who were covered. Very importantly, there was less cost for those with chronic conditions. For example, costs were 21% less for those with joint disease, 8% less for those with diabetes, and 7% less for those with hypertension. Now, this, I would suggest, is real cost reduction. Individuals in the consumer-directed plans are more engaged in managing their own health and, importantly, making informed choices. This is evidenced by the fact that use of information tools to assess cost and quality of outcomes available to individuals were used 40% more often than used by those in traditional plans. So they're getting information and they're doing something with it. Emergency room visits were 13% lower in the new plans as individuals used their doctor's office or urgent care clinics more frequently. And individuals in the new plans were almost 20% more likely to participate in health advisor and chronic illness management programs than in the control group. So my point in sharing this data is to demonstrate that, as is usually the case in our country, the marketplace is actively looking for ways to address many of our healthcare insurance challenges by reducing costs, but importantly, at the same time, improving outcomes and health status. Now, one final point that I want to leave you with. While government has a major role to play in healthcare and healthcare reform, I feel very strongly that we as individuals can also play a major role by becoming much more informed and engaged healthcare consumers. Now, I hope these remarks today have provided at least some food for thought on the healthcare reform debate, which we are clearly going to continue to have in this country for quite some time. And with that, I would be very happy to take your questions.
Thank you very much, Ed, for those
more room over
very
there.
Informed and illuminating remarks. We do have a lot of questions, and there are some questions on the same general area. Here is one of those. How do you feel that the lack of tort reform in Obamacare adds to the cost of our medical care?
Well, the lack of tort reform clearly does add cost. I think as well it adds a lot of unnecessary procedures and a lot of defensive medicine. I'm quite sure there are a number of physicians in the room. You can speak to this topic much better than I can. But there's absolutely no doubt that the legislation as written really avoids that issue. There were a lot of efforts as the legislation was put together to include some type of mechanism to make it more efficient and effective, whether that be medical courts or whatever. Unfortunately, there was not a willingness to consider those kinds of issues. But it clearly does add cost, mm-hmm. And more importantly, I think it adds a degree of complexity oftentimes for our physicians and hospitals that is somewhat unnecessary.
Thank you very much. How would cross-state competition, insurance competition, benefit the population, or would it?
You know, there is a lot of discussion about opening up for cross-state competition. Today, insurance is regulated on a state-by-state basis. As a national company, we are already operating across state lines. I think we do so relatively effectively. The one thing to remember about health insurance and healthcare generally is it is still very much a local or regionalized activity. And the nature of healthcare delivery can be very different. Mm-hmm. And the costs associated with healthcare can be very different from one state to another. So while I'm a proponent of cross-state competition, I think that would be healthy. I think anything that adds a competitive nature to a business brings lower costs and better quality. I'm not sure that I would agree that simply by opening up state borders and doing away with state regulation and approval processes, that we would generate much improved cost of insurance. Because it's still a function, insurance cost is still a function of the cost of delivery in local markets. This isn't asked for in the question, but one thing I always find interesting in a group of people is I'll ask them what their opinion is of the margins associated with healthcare insurance. And somewhat depressingly, they usually get it wrong, and it's usually at the high end that they get it wrong. You know, the average margin of a health insurer is somewhere between 3% and 5%. And so what drives healthcare insurance costs in this country is the cost of delivery of care. And whether or not that can be generalized across 50 states mm-hmm. and normalized, it remains to be seen.
Very interesting. Something I don't think we had really thought of in those terms. Bit of a follow-up. Why are urgent care clinics so much less expensive than emergency rooms? And how do their outcomes compare?
Well, first of all, urgent care clinics tend to have a more limited number of services provided. For example, we are seeing a lot of folks now taking advantage of, I'll get the terminology wrong, but medic clinics mm-hmm. Within drugstores and so forth. And they have a very narrow list of functions that they perform. Go in, get your strep test done. If you do have an infection, your prescription is written right on the spot. Obviously, if there are more serious issues, you're referred to your doctor's office or to an emergency room if it's a critical condition. So I think it involves focusing on those activities that can be delivered in that kind of setting. The quality appears to be quite good. The insurance industry at first was somewhat skeptical whether or not we wanted to reimburse for these within a benefits program. But quite frankly, we were encouraged by many employers who said, wait, this is a very legitimate way for our employees very efficiently to get routine services. Let's work hard to improve the quality of it because the costs are very meaningful. And so again, you've seen the marketplace really develop these things, and it appears they're a good alternative.
I agree with that. Next question, and sort of ties into this in a way, and this is a phenomenon which is very popular here in Florida. What will be the effects of the rapid increase in concierge medicine and the decline of doctors available to the general public.
I'll come back to concierge in a minute. You know, interestingly, the reforms that we're talking about, how many people here are from Massachusetts? I met some people earlier from Massachusetts.
At the table there.
There you go. Well, Massachusetts, of course, had health care reform under Governor Romney and put in a system that is not a lot different than what health care reforms calls for. And, by the way, costs continue to go up pretty dramatically. And the other challenge is the availability of physicians to deal with the people who were added from the ranks of the uninsured. And this is in Massachusetts, where, quite frankly, the per capita number of physicians is quite high compared to a lot of other places in the country. So, that bringing 30 million people into the insurance ranks and having them access care arguably more frequently or aggressively than they have in the past will strain the provider network, particularly in primary care. Mm-hmm. The ranks of primary care are depleted, and we need to find ways to incent more individuals to become primary care physicians. Concierge care is on the rise. It clearly is. And I think it reflects people's desire to access care in a way that is more accommodating to their lifestyles. If they have the ability to pay, they're willing to do that. And for certain physicians who feel they'd rather not deal with insurance companies like mine or Medicare, they'd rather deal directly with individuals. So you do see a rise in that. Personally, I think that will continue to be a fairly narrow swath of the population, both on the medical professional side and the individual side.
I have a personal add-on to that. What do you think of is there a moral aspect to the phenomenon?
That's an interesting question. Is there a moral relative to concierge care? Mm-hmm. In other words, people who can afford it get better
right.
care? You know, the one thing I was going to say earlier, relative to some of the other systems that we do business in around the world, they are very much two-tiered systems. So there is health insurance for people who can afford it. It tends to be the higher socioeconomic classes. And the access to care that people get at the lower levels is far different. Quite frankly, while we have some disparities in care, no question about it in this country, those disparities, in my opinion, are far less than they are in many other markets. I don't see an ethical dilemma relative to concierge care. I think the greater ethical dilemma is we shouldn't tolerate 30 million people without insurance. That's a stronger ethical dilemma for me, and there are ways to ensure that people have access to insurance and to care. That's what we ought to really deal with.
Very good. Here's an interesting question. They're all interesting, by the way, and so are your answers. What's the best way to lower the burgeoning cost of end-of-life care? Not our last question.
You know, for this group, that's a tough question. I'm going to have to answer. I think we are seeing some of that evolve. A term you often hear referred to is Superman care. And we clearly as a country need to find a way to bring that debate to the fore. If you look at, in Medicare, if you look at some of the statistics, and even in my home city, Philadelphia, if you look at the major health systems in that city and you look at the last, 30 to 60 days of life, and you look at the cost associated with those last 30 or 60 days, the variance across those delivery systems is extraordinary. One is extraordinarily high, one is extraordinarily low. And you ask yourself why. Unfortunately, the end result is the same, and we know what that is. So I do think this is a debate that the country needs to have. I think you're seeing it happened some places, but in the reform debate, for example, that suddenly was latched onto as rationing of care. Well, that's right, and somebody's going to ration that care. Hopefully, individuals will become more aggressive in determining their own desires relative to end-of-life care And I think you are seeing that. And you're seeing the whole hospice movement add to the efficiency as well as the compassion of end-of-life care. But as a country, we're going to have a tough time struggling with that one. I don't believe the answer is what you see in some developed countries, which is basically if you're at a certain age, you don't get certain procedures. It's essentially legislated or determined by budget. This country, I don't think, would be comfortable with that, nor would I. But I think it is a debate we need to have.
More to who gets care and who doesn't. Please comment on Representative Paul Ryan's concept of offering health care equal to that provided our representatives and senators.
Well, you know, our senators and representatives get a number of options, and the vast majority of them pick the highest benefit option. So they pick very expensive care. In fact, one might suggest they pick Cadillac policies, a term we may have heard in the reform debate. Let me say that I've met with Representative Ryan several times. He is an extraordinarily bright individual who has been very thoughtful about this topic. And while I don't necessarily agree with all of his ideas, he does represent a point of view that individuals should be determinant in terms of what coverage they get, how they get it, and so forth, as opposed to the government dictating it. And personally, I think that is much more in keeping with the American spirit, and I think will allow the marketplace to respond to them. His suggestions relative to Medicare are reflective of that. If you saw recently what he has proposed, or the House Budget Committee has proposed, it is take Medicare and basically give all of us vouchers that you would use to go into the private market and buy essentially Medicare Advantage policies from companies like mine. My old one, excuse me. That is a different approach. But again, most of the new ideas, most of the new concepts, most of the innovation in terms of coverage and how it's done has come from the private market. It hasn't come from Medicare or Medicaid. So I would argue that that is a very legitimate option that we ought to look at.
And I think to a certain extent you perhaps have addressed what this questioner is asking. Is Medicare doing a good job? And if so, why change the system?
I think in many areas Medicare is doing a good job. It is a very complicated program. If you ask a lot of physicians, they would say, you know what, we get reimbursed effectively. I'd rather deal with the Medicare administrators than I would the insurance companies. So in some respects, Medicare is functioning well. Unfortunately, the way it's currently constructed, it's not sustainable. I mean, it's cash flow negative in 2015, 2016. So as a practical matter, it can't continue. Whether the country has the wherewithal to have that debate about how we fix Medicare remains to be seen. I do think that there is a very important opportunity to bring private market principles to certain elements of Medicare, because we haven't seen much innovation in Medicare. But it is 50% of the healthcare dollars spent in this country. So.
Well, that answers the question. Now we're going to have a question from a student, and this is sort of a personal question. What was your motivation to become a leader in the area of health insurance, and what kept you motivated through any tough situations to become as successful as you have been?
It's interesting. The answer to how I got involved in healthcare might surprise you. I started in the insurance business in property and casualty, not in healthcare. My company at the time was a multi-line company. We did lots of different kinds of insurance. I happened to do property and casualty. The company changed over time. We did much more healthcare. And I realized that it was kind of interesting. Healthcare insurance and running a big company was a way for me to both follow my aspirations to be a leader in business, but also at the same time to do it in an area that was extraordinarily important to people, to individuals. And in spite of what you might read about healthcare insurance executives, I and the people, the 25,000 people in Cigna, felt that every day when we came to work, we made a difference in people's lives. We were trying to find ways to get better insurance policies, to help them make smarter decisions, whatever it was. And so for me, it was a great match of being part of a very significant big company, but also doing something that I thought made a difference. Now, you asked about how do you stay motivated. I would tell you through the Obamacare debates, it was pretty hard to stay motivated. Because, to be honest, about midway through the summer, before this was passed, it stopped being health care reform and started being health insurance reform, because that polled better. And that got pretty depressing because we became the guys in the dark suits. And I would tell you that there's an industry in this country that really does care about individuals and does try to do the right thing day in and day out. We don't always get it right, but we work very hard to try to. But, you know, when you're doing something you believe in and you think is right, you stay motivated. And then you retire as soon as you get it.
We're not through here just yet. Do you or anyone really know what the cost of Obamacare will actually be?
No.
No.
That's the one question I know I got right today. No, we really don't.
No.
I gave you some reasons why I don't think it's likely to be cost neutral or it's likely to really deal with the big issue in this country, which is the increasing cost of health care. It's a very complex topic. But no, I don't think anyone really knows, and only time will tell.
And the last question is, do you think that Obamacare will actually be repealed?
I think it's going to be very difficult to repeal it. I think, obviously, it probably depends on, not probably, it does depend on what happens in 2012. With the current configuration in the Senate and the House, if that were to continue, no, I don't think it would be repealed. I would tell you what bothers me even more maybe than the current legislation is, if it's not repealed, kind of a piecemeal approach to changing it. That could be extremely damaging because this thing needs to work as a whole. Let me give you one example. The individual mandate. What you might not realize is the insurance industry in 2007 went forward and said, you know what, we think there should be guaranteed issue and no pre-existing conditions, and let's have an individual requirement to have coverage so we get everybody in the insurance pool and therefore we can manage cost. The insurance industry put those proposals forward. I think what scares the insurance industry and what should scare all of us is if we start picking these pieces away, if we took the individual requirement for coverage away, then there's really no way to control costs. People will purchase insurance coverage when they need it, which will push everybody's costs up. And so repeal is one thing. What would concern me more is kind of a piecemeal approach around the edges to different pieces of it that if you change them would have unintended consequences.
Ed, thank you so very much for coming to appear in front of us. As a newcomer to Naples, and we welcome you here, glad you're here. We have a few books for you.
Great, thank you. That's
and
nice.
I must say, it's very nice to see a human side to the healthcare industry, and we're very glad that you came.
Thank you.
Thank you
very much.
We'll see you in fall.